Okay, so picture this. You're walking down the street.
Right.
It's a Tuesday morning, maybe 8 a.m. The sun is just coming up. The streetlights above you. They didn't just turn off on a timer because a clock struck 8.
They sensed the ambient light.
Exactly. They sense the light levels rising and dim themselves incrementally to save these tiny microseconds of energy. And then you finish your coffee and throw the cup into a trash can on the corner.
And that can doesn't just sit there.
No, it sends a ping to a central server saying, "Hey, I'm at 80% capacity, route the truck to me."
And the traffic lights at the intersection right next to you, they aren't blinking red and green based on some schedule program 3 years ago.
Right, they're watching.
They are watching the cars. They are adjusting the green light duration in real time to flush out a jam before it even forms.
And that is exactly the vibe we are exploring today. Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm your host, and today we are getting into a concept that, well, when I say smart city, I think most people listening have a very specific image in their heads.
Oh, absolutely. Usually involves a lot of chrome.
Yes, Chrome.
Yeah.
Or science fiction.
The Jetsons. Yeah.
Jetsons, flying cars, robot maids, glass tubes, shooting people into skyscrapers.
Yeah.
Or if you're a bit more cynical, maybe something like Blade Runner.
Minority Report.
Yes, Minority Report, a neon-soaked dystopia where the sidewalk scans your retina and judges you for walking too slowly.
That is the pop culture baggage we bring to this term. It's always either a utopian paradise or a complete surveillance nightmare. But the reality is much more beige
Beige. I like that.
and much more immediate. It is already here. It's buried in the infrastructure right now.
And that is our mission for this deep dive. We have a massive stack of source material today. Reports, case studies from Amsterdam to Beijing, technical breakdowns of what actually makes a city, quote unquote, smart.
And we really need to move past the buzzwords today. We have to figure out why governments and these massive tech corporations are absolutely obsessed with this concept.
We need to look at the machinery under the sidewalk.
Exactly. And most importantly, we have to walk that very thin line between efficient urban paradise and a totalitarian control grid.
Because, as it turns out, the city is watching you. But according to the data, it might actually be trying to save you from yourself.
Or at least save you from sitting in traffic.
Which, let's be honest, feels like saving my life sometimes.
Yeah.
So let's start with the basics. I tried to find a dictionary definition of smart city to kick this off, and I just hit a wall. Is there actually a single definition?
The short answer is no. There is no single globally accepted definition. It is an incredibly fuzzy concept.
That seems really convenient for the marketing departments of tech companies.
Oh, it is incredibly convenient. The term gets slapped on literally everything. For some people, a smart city is just digitizing public services, like Estonia, for example.
Oh, right, where everything is online.
Yes. You can vote online, file your taxes in 5 minutes. That is considered smart governance. But for others, it's not smart until you have an AI managing the water pressure in every single pipe in the city.
So it ranges from a really good website all the way to Skynet.
Effectively, yes. But if we look closely at the source material, particularly the academic breakdowns, there is a core goal that unifies all these definitions.
Right, the integration part.
Yes. It's not just about using technology for the sake of it. It's about integrating three very specific things: ICT, which is information and communication technologies, human capital, and governance.
And they combine these three things to solve one very specific, very old economic problem.
The tragedy of the commons.
Okay, so I remember this vaguely from Econ 101, but usually it's about like sheep grazing on a shared field. How does a sheep field apply to downtown Los Angeles or Beijing?
It is the exact same dynamic. Just replace the field with the road network. The commons is the road. It is a shared limited resource. Now imagine you are a driver. You want to get to work on time.
That is my self-interest.
Right. And every other driver on the road has that exact same self-interest.
So we all get in our cars at 8:30 a.m.
And because you all act on that individual self-interest simultaneously, you destroy the resource. You create gridlock. You create pollution. You waste fuel.
So by trying to save time individually, we ensure that everyone loses time collectively.
That is the tragedy.
We ruin the party because we all try to get the best slice of cake at the exact same time.
Perfectly put. Ideally, a smart city uses data to fix this collective selfishness. If the city knows where everyone is, where they are going, and how fast they are moving, it can act as a central nervous system.
It optimizes the flow.
Exactly. It manages the resource so the tragedy doesn't happen.
So the city becomes the ultimate referee.
In a way, yes. It mediates our interactions with the infrastructure to maximize efficiency for everyone.
Okay, so that is the why. Let's get into the how. the actual anatomy of a smart city. I really like the analogy in our notes comparing the city to a biological body.
It's a great framework.
Yeah, if we are building this thing from the ground up, what are the organs?
Well, at the very bottom of the tech stack, you have the sensory organs.
The eyes and ears.
Right. In a human, this is your retina, your eardrum, your nerve endings.
Yeah.
In a city, this is the hardware layer. Cameras, obviously. But also smart meters on your house, air quality sensors on lampposts, RFID tags on cargo loop detectors embedded in the asphalt to count cars.
I even read about acoustic sensors that can detect the sound of a gunshot and triangulate the exact location instantly.
Yeah, shot spotter technology and things like it. These devices are constantly collecting raw data from the physical world. But eyes are useless without optic nerves.
Right, they need to send the signal somewhere.
Exactly. So the second layer is the nerves, the connectivity.
The wired infrastructure and the IoT, the Internet of Things.
This is your fiber optic cables running underground, the 5G towers, the LoRaWAN networks.
LoRaWAN.
Low power wide area networks. They are designed specifically for sensors to ping tiny bits of data over long distances without draining their batteries.
Got it. Once. So if the sensors are the eyes, the nerves are the pathways that send that signal up to the brain.
Precisely. And that brings us to the brain. This is the intelligence layer.
This is where the magic, or depending on your view, the creepy stuff happens.
This is cloud computing, massive data centers, and artificial intelligence. The nerves dump millions of gigabytes of raw data into the brain. The brain processes it, looks for patterns, and makes decisions.
Like traffic is building up on Main Street, extend the green light on Fifth Avenue by 20 seconds.
Exactly. So it's input from sensors, transmission through nerves, and processing in the brain.
But here is where the source material threw a curveball that I found really fascinating. We tend to think of intelligence in a smart city as just silicon chips, just the AI.
Right. We assume it's all digital.
But the research actually identifies three distinct types of intelligence. And the first one has absolutely nothing to do with computers.
You're talking about orchestration intelligence.
Yes. And the example given in the sources was Bletchley Park.
Which is such a brilliant historical pull.
I mean, when I think of Bletchley Park, I think of World War II. I think of Alan Turing, cigarette smoke clicking typewriters. I do not think smart city.
But look at the definition of the term. Orchestration intelligence is about distinct institutions and communities collaborating to solve a complex problem. Bletchley Park was arguably the very first smart community.
Because they brought everyone together.
Yes, you had the military, you had mathematicians, you had crossword puzzle solvers, all orchestrated into a human computer to crack the Enigma code.
So a city can be considered smart just because its people and organizations are wired together effectively, even if they're literally using paper and pencil.
Exactly. It is about civic intelligence. Think about it. If you have all the digital sensors in the world, but your police department, your fire department, and your sanitation department refuse to share data, your city is dumb.
Orchestration is the software of human cooperation.
Beautifully stated. It's the foundational layer.
That is a really important distinction. It's not just gadgets. So what is the second type of intelligence?
Empowerment intelligence. This is about the city acting as a platform. Think of places like Kisa Science City in Stockholm or the Cyberport in Hong Kong.
I've heard of Cyberport. It's like a big tech outfit.
It is. But the intelligence part is that the city deliberately provides the infrastructure. They provide the open data, the high-speed networks, the legal frameworks so that private innovators can come in and build on top of it.
Oh, it's like a sandbox. The city builds a really good sandbox and the startups come in and build the castles.
Precisely. The city empowers the citizens and businesses to be smart. And then finally, we have the third type, which is what we usually think of. Instrumentation intelligence.
The heavy tech.
Real-time data collection. The classic example here is Amsterdam.
Okay, what is Amsterdam doing that makes them the poster child for instrumentation?
They have gone all in on the instrumented city model. They have a common IP infrastructure that connects everything. But the example that always sticks out to people is the garbage.
The solar-powered trash cans.
It sounds so mundane, but it is brilliant. Think about a normal city. A garbage truck drives a fixed route every Tuesday. It stops at every single can, whether it's full overflowing or completely empty.
Which is incredibly inefficient. It wastes gas, it creates traffic.
Yeah, noise.
Yeah, the noise of a garbage truck at 6 a.m. is the worst.
In Amsterdam, the cans are smart. They have a solar panel on top to power a small compactor inside. So first, they squash the trash, meaning they can hold up to 5 times as much.
Which is already a huge improvement.
And second, when they are finally full, they send a text message to the sanitation department. The trucks only go to the cans that actually need emptying.
See, that is the kind of utility I love. It's not a flying car, but it solves a real daily annoyance. It's practical.
And that brings us perfectly to the second section of our deep dive, the practical applications. We've built the body, we understand the brain. Now, what does this thing actually do for us on a daily basis?
Let's talk about movement, urban flow.
Yeah.
Because I think nothing makes people hate a city more than a bad commute.
Traffic congestion is actually the number one driver for smart city adoption globally. It costs billions and billions of dollars in lost productivity every year. So we are seeing the massive rise of smart mobility.
And to see the cutting edge of this, you really have to look at Asia, specifically China.
Yes, the city brain concept.
Right. This was championed by Alibaba. Right.
Yes. It started in Hangzhou, but it has been exported to places like Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia.
How is the city brain different from just a normal traffic control center with cameras?
In a traditional center, you have humans looking at a wall of screens. They react. They say, oh, there's a crash on Highway 4, dispatches a patrol car.
It's reactive.
Right. The city brain is AI-driven and predictive. It ingests data from video cameras, GPS data from public transport mapping apps, ride-sharing cars. It controls the traffic lights across the entire grid simultaneously.
That's basically playing SimCity in real time.
Exactly. And it does things humans can't. It creates a greenway for ambulances.
A greenway.
If an ambulance is moving, the brain calculates its route and turns every light green in front of it and red on all the cross streets automatically. No human intervention needed.
That is incredible for emergency services. Just clearing the path instantly. And I guess the logical next step for flow is removing the human driver entirely.
That is Baidu's Apollo project, autonomous driving. The theory is if you remove the human driver, you remove the erratic behavior. You remove the people braking for no reason looking at their phones.
You remove the tragedy of the common selfishness.
Theoretically, yes. If the cars are talking to each other and the city, they don't even really need to stop at intersections. They just weave through each other perfectly timed.
But even with human drivers, you can control flow with hardware. Did you see the note in the sources about retractable bollards?
I did.
This felt like something straight out of a spy movie to me.
It is surprisingly common in Europe, actually. A bollard is just a sturdy metal post that blocks traffic from entering a pedestrian street. Usually they are fixed in concrete, or maybe you have a padlock on them.
Right, and the delivery guy has to get out of his truck, find the key, unlock it, pull it down, drive over it, put it back up.
In a smart city, the bollard is hydraulic, and it is connected to a camera with ALPR, automatic license plate recognition.
So the delivery truck pulls up.
The camera scans the plate. It checks a central database instantly. Does this specific truck have a permit for this street at this specific time?
And if yes, the bollards just sink into the ground.
Exactly. The truck passes. The bollards rise back up.
Seamless. Highly efficient.
Very efficient.
So here comes the big. But for that system to work smoothly, there has to be a camera recording every single car that drives down that street.
And checking it against a central government database.
Which brings us crashing into the most controversial part of this anatomy, safety versus surveillance.
This is the primary friction point of the entire smart city concept. We see this heavily marketed as the safe city model.
Safe city.
Yes. Companies like Huawei and ZTE are massive players here. Their pitch to city governments is very simple and very persuasive. Use our technology to protect your citizens.
And I mean, who is going to say no to safety?
Exactly. It's a very compelling sales pitch. Catch criminals faster, find missing children, prevent accidents.
But the implementation looks a lot like a digital panopticon. The Belgrade case study really stood out to me in the materials.
This was a major flashpoint. In 2018, the Serbian government announced a partnership with Huawei to install 1,000 smart cameras across Belgrade.
1,000 cameras in one city.
And they were not just recording video. These cameras were equipped with advanced facial recognition and license plate recognition software.
So you literally cannot walk down the street without the government knowing exactly who you are, where you are, and who you are walking with.
That is the reality of the technology. The government argued it was strictly for traffic safety and catching violent criminals.
But civil rights groups argued it was the end of anonymity in public spaces.
It's where the convenience versus privacy debate stops being a theoretical academic debate and starts being a real fight.
Because if the infrastructure exists to track a known terrorist, it also exists to track a political protester.
Oh.
Or a journalist. Or an ex-girlfriend.
Precisely. The capability is fundamentally built into the hardware. It's not something you can just turn off easily once it's fully integrated into the police dispatch system.
The sources mentioned visual surveillance was one of the top three spending categories for smart cities recently, right?
In 2022, yes. This isn't a side project for these cities. It is a main pillar of the entire smart city industry.
That is definitely chilling. But let's pivot to something slightly less terrifying, but equally critical to making this all work. Energy.
Right, because all these servers, all these cameras and electric cars, they need a lot of juice.
And the power grid we have right now is kind of dumb.
Very dumb. It was built for a world where we burn a pile of coal, produce a steady stream of power, and send it one way down the wire to your house.
Plant to plug, one direction.
Right, but now we want renewable energy. Yeah. We want solar, we want wind. The problem is clouds move, the wind stops blowing, the power supply becomes highly variable.
So the grid naturally creates gaps in supply.
A smart grid uses data to balance that load dynamically. It talks to the devices in your home. It might tell your smart washing machine, hey, demand on the grid is really high right now. Wait 15 minutes to run the spin cycle.
Wow. And the concept of positive energy districts, that sounds really optimistic.
It's basically the holy grail of urban planning right now.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine a neighborhood where every single roof has solar panels. The buildings are super insulated, and they have massive local battery storage.
Okay.
The goal is for that district to produce more energy than it consumes over the course of a year.
So instead of sucking power from the city grid, it's actually feeding power back into it.
Exactly. The neighborhood itself becomes a decentralized power plant. But to do that safely, you need immense amounts of data and automated control systems to manage the flow of electricity in two directions simultaneously.
So we have the nerves, the brain, the senses.
Mm-hmm.
We have traffic that flows perfectly trashed, that calls for its own pickup,
mm-hmm.
and neighborhoods that act like giant batteries. On paper, this all sounds like a paradise of efficiency. But cities aren't made of paper. They are made of people. And this is where our deep dives gets a bit messy. We have to talk about the human element.
This is the crucial missing link in so many of these projects. You can build the most advanced digital infrastructure in the world, but if you don't have soft infrastructure, you do not have a smart city.
Can you define soft infrastructure for me?
Hard infrastructure is the fiber optic cables and the concrete. Soft infrastructure is the people. It's the local culture, the education levels, the technical literacy of the population.
So it's the human capacity to actually use the tool.
Exactly. If you launch a brilliant citywide app for reporting potholes, but 40% of your population is illiterate or elderly and can't use a smartphone, your city isn't smart. It's just exclusive.
That's a really great point. It reminds me that the Taiwan model that was detailed in the notes, they added an extra letter to the standard acronym.
Yes. So in government procurement circles, we always talk about PPP, public-private partnerships.
The government and business working together to build something.
Right. But Taiwan promotes the PPP model.
Public-private people partnership.
It sounds like a catchy marketing slogan, but it fundamentally changes the architecture of these projects. Instead of the government treating citizens like passive users or subjects to be managed, they treat them as active co-creators.
Partners.
Yeah.
How does that actually work in practice?
Look at the city of Tainan. They have initiatives where citizens are actually given air quality sensors to carry around or install on their balconies.
Oh, so the citizens are the ones collecting the data.
Yes. They collect it, they analyze it through open source platforms, and they work directly with the government to identify micro pollution hotspots.
So instead of the city watching me from above, I'm actually watching the city with my neighbors.
It democratizes the data completely. It shifts the dynamic from surveillance to participation.
Yeah.
And that requires a strong knowledge economy. Smart cities have to invest heavily in libraries, digital literacy programs, and the arts.
Because you need a smart population to run a smart city. But we have to address the elephant in the server room here. Or maybe the glitch in the matrix.
Yeah.
Not everyone is happy about this transition. There's a massive backlash brewing against the whole concept.
Oh, absolutely. And for very valid reasons. The skepticism is growing fast.
Let's talk about surveillance capitalism.
This is a term popularized by the scholar Shoshana Zuboff. It's a critical concept. It's the idea that human experience is basically being claimed as free raw material for translation into behavioral data.
Can you translate that into English for me?
Basically, if the product is free, you are the product. We accept this on social media, right? We know Facebook tracks our clicks to sell targeted ads.
Sure, we all know that bargain.
But in a smart city, that business model moves from your phone screen to your physical street.
So I walk down the sidewalk, and the city infrastructure tracks my gait, my location, my shopping habits, and then turns around and sells that to an advertiser.
Or uses it to artificially raise land values. The fear is that the city isn't being optimized for the residents' happiness or well-being. It's being optimized for corporate data extraction.
Are we building cities for people? Or are we building cities as massive data farms for tech vendors?
That is the exact question critics are asking.
That is a very dystopian thought, and it gets even darker when you look at how that data is used by the state. Predictive policing.
This is one of the most contentious applications of AI in urban spaces.
The idea is simple, right? You feed historical crime data into an algorithm and let it predict where crime will happen next.
Yes. And ideally, you send patrol cars there before the crime even happens. Very Minority Report.
But algorithms are only as good as the data you feed them.
Precisely. Garbage in, garbage out. If your historical data is heavily biased, for example, if the police have historically over-policed minority neighborhoods for minor offenses, the data will show, quote-unquote, more crime in those specific areas.
Because that's where they were looking.
Right. The AI doesn't know the historical context. It just sees raw numbers. So it tells the police commander to patrol those specific neighborhoods even more heavily today.
Which inevitably leads to more arrests in those neighborhoods.
Which creates more data confirming that's where the crime is. It becomes a closed feedback loop, a mathematical justification for racial profiling hidden behind the veneer of objective technology.
So the smart city just automates and amplifies the prejudices of the past.
It absolutely can if we aren't incredibly careful with how these algorithms are audited.
And then there is the digital divide. We touched on this with the soft infrastructure point. But seriously, if the city runs on an app, what happens to my grandmother?
Or the homeless population. Or the working poor who can't afford a reliable data plan. If accessing basic government services, like applying for public housing or paying a parking fine, requires high-tech access, you effectively create a caste system.
The connected class and the disconnected class.
Yes. You become a second-class citizen in your own hometown just because you don't have the right smartphone.
This isn't just theoretical either. There was a very specific story in the source notes about the Salisbury controversy.
Ah, yes, the Salisbury case in 2023 in South Australia. This is a classic textbook example of how not to roll out smart infrastructure.
Oh, happened.
The local government in Salisbury proposed a fairly standard smart city rollout. Smart streetlights, CCTV environmental sensors, the usual works.
And I assume the city council thought the residents would be thrilled to have better lighting and safer parks.
They almost certainly did. Instead, the proposal exploded. There was a massive, intense community backlash.
Why?
Conspiracy theories started spreading like wildfire that this was the beginning of a Chinese-style social credit system, or that it was a quote-unquote 15-minute city lockdown grid designed to restrict movement.
Why was the reaction so hostile to just streetlights and sensors?
Because there was absolutely no trust. The government came in top down. They basically said, we're installing this. It's for your own good. They didn't use the PPP model.
They didn't partner with the people.
Right. When people don't understand the underlying technology and they already don't trust the government's motives, they will inevitably view smart features as weapons of control.
It really shows that you can't just engineer a city like it's a motherboard. You have to govern it.
Trust is the actual currency of the smart city. If you spend it all or lose it, the whole system fails no matter how good the tech is.
There's one more major risk I want to highlight from the deep dive materials. Mm. We've talked about hacking, which is obvious if everything is online, but the lock-in effect.
Vendor lock-in. This is a huge economic trap for municipalities.
Explain how that works.
Imagine a mid-sized city signs a massive 10-year contract with a giant tech conglomerate, let's just call them megacorp, to run their traffic lights, their water sensors, and their emergency dispatch systems.
Okay, they hire megacorp.
They install megacorp's proprietary sensors, proprietary software, and proprietary servers.
Right.
5 years later, the city wants to change how a system works. Or maybe megacorp suddenly jacks up the maintenance prices by 40%. The city decides they want to switch to a different, cheaper software provider.
But they can't.
Exactly. Nothing else on the market is compatible with megacorp's physical sensors.
Because the code is closed.
Right. To switch providers, the city would literally have to dig up every single street and replace every physical sensor in the asphalt. It's prohibitively expensive.
So the city's completely trapped.
They effectively lose their digital sovereignty to a private corporation. The corporation dictates the terms of the city's infrastructure.
That is terrifying. It's like being trapped in the Apple ecosystem, but instead of your photos, it's your entire municipal water supply.
And finally, there is the deep environmental irony of all this. We say these cities are green, we love the solar compactors in Amsterdam, but the infrastructure itself has a massive physical cost.
Like the Jevons paradox.
In a way, yes. Think about the brain we talked about. The massive data centers required to process all this real-time AI data consume colossal amounts of electricity and millions of gallons of water just for cooling the servers.
Right, the cloud is actually a physical building somewhere burning energy.
And the millions of physical sensors require rare earth minerals, lithium, cobalt, copper. Mining those materials is devastating to the environment.
So there is a real risk that the environmental footprint of building the smart city actually outweighs the energy savings from having smart streetlights dimming at night.
It is a very precarious balancing act. Every single efficiency gained has a hidden physical cost somewhere else on the globe.
So bringing this all together, we have the nerves, the brain, the senses, we have the incredible flow of traffic, but we have algorithmic biases and vendor lock-in and surveillance capitalism. What is the final verdict from the sources? Where is all of this actually going?
The overarching consensus is that the technology itself is inevitable. We aren't going to suddenly stop putting microchips in things. Moore's Law doesn't care about our privacy concerns. But the application of that technology, that is entirely a political choice.
So we are standing at a fork in the road right now.
We are. And one path leads straight to the technocratic city.
What does that look like?
A city entirely run by algorithms. It is hyper-efficient. It is clean. It is cold. It's a place where the human citizen is reduced to just another data point to be managed and optimized by the system. A city that flows perfectly, but where no one is truly free from observation.
And the other path?
The human-centric city. This is a city where the technology is almost completely invisible. It operates quietly in the background, not to control us, but to support human flourishing.
Like clearing the traffic so we actually have more time to spend with our families at home.
Exactly. It monitors the air quality so our kids are healthier. It empowers the citizen to participate rather than just harvesting their data for profit.
It's the difference between a city that just watches you and a city that actually sees you.
That is a profound way to put it, yes.
So here is my challenge for you listening to this right now. Next time you are waiting at a busy intersection on your commute, just look up. Don't just look at the red light. Look for the camera lens mounted next to it. Look for the little gray box bolted to the street lamp.
Look for the subtle sensor on the side of the trash can.
And ask yourself a simple question. Is this serving me? Is it helping me get home safer and faster? Or is it just another data point in a server farm somewhere calculating my value?
It is arguably the most important question you can ask about your modern environment.
Keep looking for those invisible threads, everyone. The city is getting smarter every single day. Make sure you are too. We will see you in the next deep dive.